From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Bierock, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Area scientists are becoming increasingly concerned with buffel grass in southern Arizona and how it's impacting biological conservation efforts. Today, Robert Rappaport talks with two local researchers. The Southern Arizona Community Diaper Bank is currently experiencing a shortage in diapers to give to those in need. Peter Michaels interviews the executive director, Cheryl Smith, and will feature the music of violinist Vicky Brown. She has a new album out called Winter Garden. Those stories and more are coming up, but first. For over a decade, buffel grass has concerned area researchers. They fear a loss of the natural desert. Robert Rappaport has more.
It started harmless enough in the late 1930s as an African import for cattle grazing and a possible solution for soil erosion. But buffel grass now is considered to be a dangerous invasive species covering all mountain ranges and urban areas in the Sonoran Desert. To get a first-hand look at the problem, two scientists and I recently took a short hike up Tumamoc Hill, west of downtown Tucson, a site that is covered in buffel grass. Tumamoc is the home of the U.S. Geological Survey's Desert Laboratory, a joint venture of the federal government and the University of Arizona. Principal research specialist Travis Bean coordinates the Buffel Grass Eradication and Outreach Program on Tumamoc.
Buffel grass fills in the interspaces between our perennial plants in the Sonoran Desert. So our Sonoran Desert is kind of characterized by these widely spaced plants. And so even if we were to go pour gasoline on a mesquite or a Palo Verde, throw a match in there, that mesquite or Palo Verde would burn to the ground, but it doesn't have anywhere to go because there's no fuel continuity. What buffel grass does is adds a continuity to the fuel continuity of the landscape so our fires can spread over tens or thousands of acres.
Buffel grass, which Bean says is spread by seeds in the air and moving vehicles, is a bushy grass, which he describes as frumpy-looking, with wide leaves and foxtail tips. USGS senior scientist and adjunct professor at the University of Arizona, Dr. Julio Betancourt, says if something isn't done soon, the ecosystem in the Sonoran Desert will change forever.
We're afraid that what we're seeing here is actually the unhinging of an American ecosystem, a unique American ecosystem. This is the only first world country where you can visit columnar cacti. If you travel around the country like I do a lot of times. People talk about, you know, when they were 16 coming to Tucson with their family and how taken they were with the landscape. I think you can also expect property values near buffel grass stands to actually go down. And the cost of fighting fires in this area is going to rise. Most of our firemen are actually answering 911 calls for the elderly in Tucson, not fighting fires.
Aside from altering the ecosystem, Betancourt says buffel grass also will change future fire dynamics.
When I first came to Tumamoc Hill in 1981 and sort of established my base here, this is an 860-acre preserve that's been studied for 100 years. Tumamoc Hill has basically never burned. There's never really been a fire of any extent of, let's say, more than an acre on Tumamoc Hill. Now Tumamoc Hill is actually covered for about 40% of the reserve covered with flammable stands of buffel grass. Adjacent to us is A Mountain, which is pretty much in the same state, maybe a little further along.
Betancourt says one of the greatest symbols of the Sonoran Desert may begin to disappear if buffel grass takes an even greater hold on the region.
We're going to start losing a lot of these saguaro stands to fire. So we're really concerned that the resource base, particularly the resource base that things like the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan, which is a $175 million plan to actually buy a lot of open space and set it aside for biological conservation primarily, we're concerned that what we could end up buying is something that is in transition to becoming a flammable Africanized grassland.
Eradicating buffel grass won't be an easy or inexpensive job. In a recent presentation to the Pima County Board of Supervisors, Betancourt told the board it needs to spend a lot of money soon to mitigate the danger of what the state officially deems a noxious weed.
More money has been spent on buffel grass eradication this year than any other previous year, but you're still talking about maybe 100,000 or, you know, between 100,000 and 200,000 probably for the whole county. And it's going to be millions of dollars. at least initially, until we can reduce the populations so that they're not growing exponentially.
Dr. Betancourt says measurements at Saguaro National Park show buffelgrass is doubling in numbers every year. He says doing nothing is not a good option.
If we don't nip it in the bud now, we're going to end up dealing with the consequences, and it's not a matter of 20, 30 years. The consequences are actually just a few years away, and every year that we fail to do something, it's going to get worse. There are a lot of people that are apt to kind of throw up their hands and say, boy, this is really so advanced that we might not be able to do anything. But I actually think millions of dollars is not that much money.
Even though buffelgrass is fully entrenched in the desert, Betancourt says he still thinks it's not too late to control it if everybody helps.
I think it's very doable. I actually don't even think it's as expensive as most people think. You just have to have the political will, the organization, and the cooperation among jurisdictions and government jurisdictions. And I think that the public has to play a major role. They need to learn how to recognize buffelgrass, take care of it in their own yards and in their own neighborhoods. And I think through volunteer efforts like Sonoran Desert Weed Whackers, which is a Pima County-supported volunteer program that works in the Tucson Mountains, I think those kind of efforts, you can actually do a heck of a lot.
You can find links on how to identify, kill, and remove buffelgrass at our website, KUAZ.org. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Robert Rappaport.
Up next on Arizona Spotlight, Peter Michaels talks with Cheryl Smith, Executive Director of the Southern Arizona Community Diaper Bank. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. For those who need them, diapers are a necessity. On average, a normal infant uses up to 12 diapers a day, and a normal toddler up to 8 a day. Among the elderly population, 15 to 20% suffer some degree of incontinence, and for some, their monthly income just can't cover the expense. For years, the Southern Arizona Community Diaper Bank has been collecting diapers to distribute to those in need. Peter Michaels recently sat down with Cheryl Smith, the executive director of the Diaper Bank, to talk about this issue and how it's affecting our community's vulnerable population.
First of all, why don't you tell us what the Southern Arizona Diaper Bank is and how it got started?
Well, the Southern Arizona Community Diaper Bank is a nonprofit organization that began with a little holiday diaper drive 13 years ago by an agency that was working with some couple nonprofits in town and said, what can we do to help you? And they said, you know, we spend a lot on diapers for our clients that live, that we take in, and if you could get some, it would help. So they got a station to do a live remote, and over the next couple weeks collected 20,000 diapers that very first time. And suddenly there were 30 agencies saying, we need help too, and they were collecting at the holidays about 300,000. And at that point, about 6 years ago, said, this needs to become its own entity, and we incorporated and got our nonprofit status. Our mission is to help people in our community who are most vulnerable and most in need to get over the hump. But the greater part of our mission is helping people to understand why and how people get in such a position.
And who identified the need here in Tucson? And is this a similar problem in other states or in other cities?
The need was first identified and by that first diaper drive by two people who own an agency called Resolve here in town, Hildy Gottlieb and Dimitri Petropoulos. And they didn't realize that the need was what it was until they got into it. And as they got into it, realized the impact the diapers have on people's lives, or the lack of the supplies have on people's lives. You know, we're talking about just a whole array of people who are affected, from women who may leave an abusive situation in the middle of the night with their two kids under their arms and the clothes on their back and go to a shelter for help. What do they do while they get back on their feet if we're not there to help? from the teen moms trying to make a living and get past the decisions and maybe bad decisions they made early in their life to get their education. They can't, and no one can take their child to daycare and leave them in daycare without diapers, without disposable diapers. So in that way, we help people get on their feet, become self-sufficient. 20% of those we serve are the elderly or those living with disabilities, from the child who has a disability who may never outgrow the need for diapers. I've talked to a couple of our partners in schools, school principals, who say, we have kids in this school, in high school, who couldn't be in school if they couldn't get disposable diapers. And the families of these kids very often are really stretched to the end. They're maxed out because of the financial, medical financial situation.
And these diapers are not cheap.
Absolutely not. Diapers for children run an average of 22 to 25 cents per diaper. The elderly, who we serve as well, and those older with disabilities that require adult supplies, are 50 cents apiece. For both of those, that computes to almost $100 a month. So those on fixed incomes, the elderly with their Social Security, the new average for Social Security is $960 a month. But that means at least half of those people are making less. And I got a call recently from an 80-year-old woman who said, I have $400 a month in income, and that's all I have. I don't know what to do. Most of the people we serve, especially younger families, are the working poor, are people who aren't trying to use the system, who are trying to make ends meet, but get to the end of the month and have $20 left in their pocket and 4 days till payday, no food, no diapers. What do they do?
And there are no other government agencies that provide this kind of service to...
No, it's really interesting because all those agencies that are meant to be safety nets to help people who are in crisis living in poverty, whether it's women, infants, and children, the WIC program, mm-hmm. The food stamp program, Medicaid, don't cover diapers. And I suppose that is because when it initially started, you know,
nobody
disposable, yeah, weren't there. The other, and Medicare will cover if you are in hospice and at the end of life. But again, it's a thing they didn't think of. We had just recently a family that moved here with a disabled child and had come from another state where the Medicaid did give them supply diapers. They filed suit and have temporarily won anyway, and so they are starting to cover them here. And I said to one of our agencies working with children with disabilities, this is really great. This is going to help because you will be able to get them. She said, yes, but what you don't know is they still have a maximum allotment a month. So if they choose to use part of that on diapers, it takes away from something else, whether it's housing or the other supplies that they need. So it can help, but it's not the answer yet.
You touched on this earlier about why it's disposable diapers. Why not cloth diapers?
Well, it sounds really good. I mean, ideally, that would be the choice for all of us. The issues that we see are that, number one, you can't get them in larger sizes, and I don't know that I would like to take care of my family with, 70-some-year-old that with cloth diapers. And the child going to school can't use those. The other thing is, the thing I mentioned before is that daycares and require disposables because they can't care for the cloth. The other thing is a lot of the people that we work with and serve either don't have a car or don't have a washer and dryer. So to keep those in a sanitary area with the chemicals and all the stuff, schlep them on a bus to the nearest laundromat is not really very realistic and don't think something a lot of us would do. So it sounds good, and wouldn't it be nice, but it isn't the real world these days.
And the manufacturers of the diapers, they don't make any contribution to the...
No.
No. And are there other programs like this in other states?
When this was started and we researched the country and actually the world, we found no one else doing this. So to our knowledge, the Southern Arizona Community Diaper Bank was the very first in probably the whole world.
And how do people help?
people help by collecting diapers for us. We work with schools, businesses, neighborhoods. Your bridge group can do it. I had a birthday party for my husband and said, don't bring presents, bring an adult diaper. And they all said, you've got to be kidding. Said, absolutely not. And we collected a couple thousand supplies. You can collect any way that you want to, if it's individually or with a group. You can donate your time. We always need volunteers to help deliver and pick up. You can help us count and warehouse. You can donate money. Any of those things are things that we need. And we are in an extreme shortage right now. We tend to get more donations of size 1s and size 3s for some reason. We're okay on adults. We just recently had an adult drive. But we are almost, our shelves are bare of certain sizes. So if anybody wants to donate anything immediately, we desperately need all those sizes other than 1s and 3s and adults.
Cheryl, thank you very much for coming
in. Thank you.
To find out how you can help the Southern Arizona Community Diaper Bank, you can call 325-1400. That's 325-1400. Stay tuned to Arizona Spotlight. When we continue, local violinist Vicki Brown will be in our studios. She'll talk about her new album called Winter Garden. You're listening to Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Vicki Brown, a local musician, has released her debut solo album. It's called Winter Garden and is comprised of 8 instrumental violin pieces, sure to evoke imagery you'll be familiar with. The self-produced album was recorded in 2005 in her home. She joins me now in our studios. Vicki, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
How do you describe the album? What's the overall mood and theme?
I don't know if there's a really overarching theme to it. What came out of this whole process were various themes. And more often than not, I would start just playing something and then I would run with it. I didn't have like a continuous thread or any particular theme that I wanted to highlight. I was really surprised at everything that came out of it.
So you just kind of started playing and whatever came.
Yeah, some of the pieces I worked on extensively and others, they were just a one-shot take. I would just turn the mic on and see what happens, and then I kept it because I really knew that it was going to be difficult to emulate that, and it was more reflective of the state of mind that I was in at the time.
There's a very interesting description on your MySpace page, and after listening to the album, I think it's a great description of Winter Garden. It says, it sounds like psychosonic landscapes, haunted houses, a clock shop gone berserk, wide open prairies where red-winged blackbirds call out for cattail stalks, deep rumbling mufflers, sad Civil War widows, rustic countryside, stone house drunken dancers. Would you say that sums it up?
I would say so. I think that runs the gamut. The only thing that's missing is a star exploding. I learned about the birth and death of stars while I was recording this, and that's the only description I think that's lacking in there.
The opening track on the album is called Take Flight. Can you talk about writing this piece?
Take Flight is, to me, reflective of the fact that that was the first piece that I had written, and it allowed me to really kind of spread my wings and take off with this whole project and with the fact that I could actually create music on my own, because that was something coming from a classically trained background. I didn't think that I was going to be able to accomplish very easily, and I found myself doing it. And it's really special to me because it is the first piece that I composed, and it's also the piece that really resonates with a lot of people.
Why do you think that is?
I'm not quite sure why it resonates with people, other than the fact that you just don't hear this music very often, for one thing, and there's a continuous movement to it, and at the same time, there's diversity in it, and there's a beautiful buildup in the end, and that has a nice resolution to it.
Well, here it is. This one's called Take Flight.
Thank you.
was the process of recording the album? Did you record each instrument and then kind of mix them together, or did you have collaborators?
No, I started this whole project on my own at home. I was approached by the label that this is on, Keep Recordings, here in town. The gentleman who runs it had always wanted to feature violins, and he had seen me playing, and he asked me if I'd be interested in producing an album, and I said, sure. And I had no idea what I was doing, and I had no money to go into the studio, so I acquired all this equipment, and I did everything in my house, which is in an old adobe structure downtown. And the process, I started it last September, and I finished it, I think, in April. And it's very consuming. Feel like I really grew out of it.
Well, does that make it hard to perform it live if you worked on every aspect of the album?
Some of the pieces, yeah, I feel like some of them are going to be really, really difficult to emulate ever again, because it was just, you know, building from whatever instruments were available and starting to mess around with, I use a looper. And so you can record something and it'll keep going, and then you can layer on top of that. And so some of the pieces are a little more difficult to emulate live, and that's one thing I'm learning. And others, I probably will eventually have other people play a role on, because I can't cover all the areas. A good friend of mine plays on one of the pieces. Paul Niehaus plays pedal steel guitar. So that's the only other instrumentation other than myself. Some of the sounds that you hear on some of the tracks are jars full of shells or beads being run across a guitar string. I'm thumping the violin at certain times. I like to abstract the violin to the point of where it doesn't sound like a violin anymore.
Well, I think one of my favorite pieces on the album when I was listening to it this morning is a piece called Left in the Wake. As I was listening to it, I thought it sounded eerie and kind of sad, but also kind of soothing at the same time. Can you talk about writing the piece?
Yeah, it was actually this time last year. I was playing with a friend of mine out on the back porch. I started playing When the Saints Go Marching In, and this friend of mine suggested, well, what happens if you slow that down? And I started playing it really slow, and I realized how mournful of a, it's almost dirge-like. You could turn it into, you know, instead of it being a parade atmosphere with that typical sound of that song, if you slow it down and also turn it into a minor key instead of the traditional major key, it sounded just so appropriate for the whole Katrina incident. And Left in the Wake, it's just, yeah, people got left in the wake of Katrina.
Where did you study music?
I studied music in, since grade school, from the age of 9. And I was trained until I was about 17, and just trained in school. But since then, I've not taken lessons or anything like that. I've just played in some orchestras here and there. So I don't have any real formal training past high school.
When did you realize you just wanted to focus on the violin?
After I finished graduate school here, I finished in 2003, and I kept pulling the violin out once in a while to remind myself that I could play, and it was very meditative. It kind of cleared my head. But living down in the barrio here in Tucson, being surrounded by all these great musicians and artists, and hearing these sounds, just riding my bike home from school, thinking, this is what I want to do. I want to participate. I want to do that.
As you were writing the album and once it was finished and you kind of listened to everything as a whole, all the pieces coming together as an album, what in your mind, what track really kind of stood out and really kind of is different from all the different pieces on the album? Which track would that be?
The last one, Core Oscillation. I think primarily because knowing all of the work that went into it, that was a really intensive piece.
Yeah. How so?
Well, there's lots and lots of tracks on it. I think I had up to 8 tracks. But just putting pieces together, you know, it wasn't just me playing the violin, picking a tune and running with it. This was really a very constructed, very crafted piece. And that's the one that I think, most proud of, just because I know I can pull that off.
Vicki Brown, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Julie.
Vicki Brown will be playing tonight at Plush with the Low Ones. For more information on where Vicki will be performing around town, you can go to her website at vickibrown.net. Here's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
This weekend, there's a 3-day celebration of music and film. The Rialto Theater, Club Congress, and the Screening Room are all participating in the 2nd annual Tucson Music and Film Festival and Club Congress's 21st birthday celebration, with far too many bands to mention and movies as well. For information, check hotelcongress.com/21st online or the Rialto Theater box office at 740-1000. On stage with the Top Hat Theater Club, it's The Foreigner by Larry Hsu this weekend. Their stage is located at Fort Lowell and Country Club. And on Sundays, for the family, The Snow Maiden will premiere at the All Together Theater, 327-4242 for information. With this look at what's going on this weekend in Tucson, this is Mark McLemore for Arizona Spotlight.
Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood, with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight programs are available online at kuaz.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Julie Bierock.